This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. There's a new girl in town, Erica Wright. She's here from New York City, and she's now in Washington. And she's here with a new book and a new poem, and here's her voice.
The Twin Nature of Wedding Guests. The groom gets drunk enough to lose a feeling in his hands and events a cure for loneliness by accident. Who needs inoculation? The bystanders have never known such promise and take it out on each other. There's a ride home with too much singing for those who still have the ache, those who tuck their heads against the glass, watch their noses in reflection, remember earlier trips in the back seat of Mom and Dad's Chrysler, when they thought their skin looked nice in the headlamps of other cars. The driver wishes everyone can move faster along the highway, longs for the quiet return. And this dual longing, to be loved and to be left alone, there is no cure for it and never will be.
That's the big question, isn't it, Erica? There is no cure for it. And by the way, this poem, I'm sure, was written a while ago, but Erica just got married this week.
That's true.
Erica Wright, our poet sitting right here, is a new bride of like 10 days or 5 days, and she looks like she's still in a glow. So we're going to use that glow for our poems. This is Erica Wright. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. What is the name of this book, and what's it about?
The name of the book is All the Bayou Stories End with Drowned, and I actually wrote the title poem first. It was inspired by a newspaper article that was published in Houston about flooding. This has been almost a decade ago. It was not about the recent floods, but it was an article that was focusing on these five children who were unfortunately lost. And the article was very moving, and at the very end, there was a small paragraph that listed the names of the others who had been lost in the flood. And I understand the journalism's decision to focus on the children, but I thought every name there had a story, and had all made an effort to survive, and all had these rich lives. And that was really one of the themes I wanted to explore in the book, is the sort of links that people go to try to survive catastrophe or personal tragedies. And that's a theme I try to weave again and again into the poems.
Well, here's who she is. She's the author of other poetry collections besides All the Bayou Stories End with Drowned. Her other ones are Instructions for Killing the Jackal. And her poems have appeared in many of our most prestigious magazines. She's the editor of Guernica magazine, as well as former editorial board member of Alice James Books, a time-honored press. Her debut crime novel, The Red Chameleon, was one of Oprah magazine best books of the summer in 2014. That should carry you a long way. And her new novel, The Blue Kingfisher, is going to be released in the fall. Those are amazing, amazing accomplishments. Erica Wright, give us another poem.
Discrepancies. My face rearranges, and it's beginning to trouble me. The new passports, glasses, fear of the bedroom mirror, that there's someone else here besides me. Will this forehead bring you back? Should I disguise my voice sotto voce, charm you with the lies I know you'll like? My breasts may give me away, but my hips are lower somehow. The truth is, we can be addicted to anything, the hymns a witness next door, or letting the RPMs rise dangerously before shifting. I've grown taller, not taller, thinner, and could crack in two given the right application of weight. Each morning, an unveiling. Let's see if the parts still work.
And each day we are different people, aren't we? Yes, there is a mist of surreality in your book. What do you think I mean by that?
Well, in this particular poem, I was thinking about the concept of facial blindness, which is a real disorder where individuals are unable to distinguish between faces. So a close friend could approach you on the street and you wouldn't know who they are. Oliver Sacks had it. He wrote about it, I believe, in the New Yorker. But I was thinking that there is this disconnect with our own appearance sometimes, that especially as we age, or maybe we have a photograph from a different angle where we don't normally see ourselves, and there's this surprise, there's this almost a moment of confusion. And I wanted to explore that concept. And in this poem, I don't always remember the origins of my poem, but this one I remember the exact age I was. I was 29, had a series of fairly small medical problems, nothing major, but I was sort of constantly at the doctor. And each morning I would sort of think to myself humorously, what's going to be broken today? Let's see if the parts still work. So that's what really kind of started this poem.
Human beings are fragile things, aren't they?
So fragile.
And we are changing every minute, and we get deformities, we get maladies, but the poet sees something else. And you always throw a very slant light on everything and come at everything, not completely from the front. You always come at it from the side, and we'll explore that more with your next poem. Erica Wright.
Lola and the Apocalypse. She sees catastrophe in every crow, in every knockdown clothesline, mostly volcanoes and floods, but sometimes scourges, blue tongues, waves that forget their place and storm into cities. Her mind stops at flesh peeling back from the bone until it's white as milk, the kind that makes grown men grow breasts, and they feel that this is a catastrophe, but it's not. Once, when men were automobiles, the roads were slick with sweat. They gleamed. Days were lost to spectatorship, making bets on which color would rise up out of the dark. Our girl made $20 on violet, but someone stole it. Who knows who? It was hard to tell one chrome from another. You couldn't cross for fear of getting hit, a parade of reds and browns. And maybe the afterlife is a bookshop, and she's been good, so she'll get to loiter by pop culture slash crime instead of business slash money. From her perch, she'll count personality types. The schizotypals will never object when she fondles their frontal lobes, that gray, dirty satin, elbow deep in it. Her epigraph will remain unwritten because there's no one left to scrawl platitudes. For every pain, there is a duck with your name on it. But there aren't any ducks. At ponds worldwide, they ate each other when no guests toss crumbs and shoot away the geese that strike as if their bodies are lit fuses. When cities were coal mines, the children played color games too, but it was too hard to determine a winner. Lola knew a man there who didn't balk at anything, could stare down whatever slime-bellied beast approached their home. She can't recall his name, but it could have been Roger. They had books too, mostly cultural studies. Maybe I'm not alone, she thinks. Maybe the devil stalks me right this minute, wants me to run, make it more exciting. Lola sits down on the nearest ledge. Ha, she thinks. Ha, ha. She doesn't notice the fissure at first. It sneaks between floorboards, and when she pries them apart, her fingertips bleed in protest. They drip onto the bleach-white worms that catch fire in the light, and then the floor collapses, and then the world. The survivors are called hostages, or will be if any are met. Hostages in pines, hostages in barns, hostages in the great wide open that makes them feel slit, wrist to armpit, in littleness.
You know, I could just close my eyes and go through an Alice in Wonderland world with you, which is much more beautiful, lyrical, and vivid, I would say, than Alice in Wonderland. But how you put disparate things together and how it gains motion and becomes a narrative is extraordinary. But the word surreal still means something. What do you think that word means?
For me, a surrealism is almost kind of a parallel to our world, that there are elements of that are familiar, they're elements that we would recognize, but they are presented in such a way that they become unfamiliar.
Oh, that is such a good explanation. Nobody's ever done it so well, because the key thing is that it must be tethered to the real world.
Right.
And that's why your things work, because although you go on many flights, very vivid flights, there is still a connection to actual people, actual emotions, and actual things. So we don't get lost in the wilderness. And let's see if that's true with the next poem. We're at the Library of Congress with Erica Wright.
spontaneous human combustion. You can't mask the scent of sulfur once it sets in the upholstery. That's as far as we've come in understanding. Someone was here, and now he's not. Sometimes your insides want to become your outsides, and you have to tell them no. I remember chaud, but I've forgotten the French for cold. The sensation of needing to burrow, of nosing dirt aside to bury myself in the basement's crawl space. There's a sound like swing set chains unwinding, not like the time I snipped my ring finger while maneuvering scissors. Blood pooled, and there was no way to test for tetanus. The great chasm of years since inoculation weighed on me, lockjaw, as if a key went missing, along with the ability to tell someone, look out, the sky hasn't looked friendly for days. I do not like to argue, even with people I love, but there's only accident out there in the flatlands, bright as any phenomena, cruel as any store-bought pyre.
Erica, when you write a poem, do you go back as if you were the first person on earth and maybe a child with a sense of innocence and wonder and start from there? Because these are squeaky clean images that only come in fairy tales. So where do you go inside of yourself to access that? That's a wonderful place to live, better than the real world.
Well, I like that description better than what I will say. But my first book of poems was very much dealing in Greek mythology and also the Greek tragedies, so Aeschylus and Euripides and Sophocles. And I really wanted to access a more accessible mythology in this book. And I think fairy tales is a great word to use. So I was thinking about how children interact in the world and how they often have these sort of adult weights put on them that they must figure out how to navigate. And I think imagination is one way to navigate that world, too.
And don't you think that there's a child in you with an IQ of 200?
I don't know. I was not a very precocious child, but maybe I'm.
Well, you are
imagining.
A precocious adult, so it just took a while. Yes. And remember, she's also a novelist, so we're going to have to find out about that. But right now, we're just yumming up her poetry. This book is called All the Bayou Stories End with Drowned. And that came from an actual event. But then she leaps forward into all aspects of life and puts a lot of sparkle, fairy dust, and reality all mixed up.
I think I'll read the title poem next. All the Bayou Stories End with Drowned. Even the fairy tales resort to air machines, as if we can't keep our boys and girls above water for very long. Some jaws got him, I seen him. The blurry shoreline, here is safe, here is not. Or let's blame the tree light, it slithers and makes us call our neighbors. But there really isn't anyone out there. The real haunting is the light itself. Everything else ends with decision, skull crushed, heart stopped, bled. Even aphids make patterns that can be imitated, cut into lace, and the circles get smaller in the search as the townsfolk trawl into other landscapes.
And that came with some sympathy attached to it, didn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that in the newspaper article, five children had been lost, and how devastating for the family and also devastating for the community. And in some ways, I was exploring the hopelessness of trying to look for lost children. The bodies of these children were recovered, but I was thinking about, in floods in general, how that is such an important but bleak task to go out and try to recover remains as a comfort to the families.
What is your geographic lineage? You were born in Texas?
Close. I did live in Texas, but I was born in Tennessee. So I spent the first 18 years of my life in rural Tennessee. And
How does that inform your poetry?
I think in this collection in particular, I really tried to embrace the strangeness of my hometown. I think it took me a while to realize how odd it is actually to grow up in a town of 500 people. Because for you, of course, it's normal. It's normal to know absolutely every person there. It's normal for everyone to know your life story and your relatives and whether or not you went to the movies with a friend on Friday night. And it took me a while to sort of embrace the strangeness also of living so close to wilderness, that if you are in a rural community like that, that you have encounters with snakes and coyotes and snapping turtles and leeches, and that it's in some ways a very physical way to interact with the world. So I was trying to actually actively explore these themes.
Are they in your novels?
They are not. My novels are very urban, but I would love to explore this more in my fiction as well.
You may have another chance.
I might.
In the future. Okay, and back to the poems.
Communion. We don't mention that kind of blindness anymore. We don't drag our toolboxes out in the middle of parking lots, rearrange them according to color, slate to red handle, then put them up again, because when everything's broken, why start now? Hush your mouth, someone says in the gas station. There's church on Sunday, and everyone has to look the preacher in the eye to say goodbye, and everyone has to say goodbye before they go home. Maybe this is no town we've ever been before, just one with the same boarded-up school and a stove under that hollowed oak that needs cutting down. Inside, copperheads nest with rat snakes, each with his task, each with his length of bark in the evening. Yes, this could be a different oak. This could be a different day when all of us decide to leave, and then the car won't start. We close our eyes instead and see stretches of highway, brands making new off the assembly line. We see silos that are towers in the right light, and the right light is among us now. The metal beckons travelers to sidle up to its expanse, rest a bit before big city limits gobble them right on up. When we shift our loneliness to another hip, the skin left behind is imprinted. Acute angles that pulse until the blood pushes everything smooth. This is not like scarring. Not like running as only children can run without looking to see what's ahead, trusting that no one would throw something toward an abandoned well for knees to hit with such force that, for a moment, nothing hurts at all.
Shift our loneliness to another hip. I think you're a poet. Now, you went from Tennessee to Texas to somehow, and you wound up in Manhattan.
I went straight from Wartrace, Tennessee, of 500 people, to Manhattan. And I was bewildered, and I consider it something of a miracle that I survived.
And what would you prefer?
I love the energy of cities. I do. There are things I miss so much about living in the country, but you can't get the same amount of art and culture and people, and just sort of to walk down the street. And also to be anonymous is something that I craved as a child. And I love that in a city. I love that you can get lost in a city.
And you can get a blood transfusion of energy every day.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Erica Wright, take a poem and read it to us first, and then peel it for us. Tell us all about the story, how you got there, what's going on with you, and let us in. So here she's going to dissect a poem for us. And what is the poem you've chosen?
I've chosen American Highways and Billboard Country. The ads lie breathlessly, silk their way into our cars until we wonder if models comb their hair with olive oil or if the shine comes from a diet of Pepsi and trail mix, $3.99 at the Winn-Dixie across from the laundromat. This is no town we'll stop in, but what if the mayor plans in his sleepless nights a jubilee even better than the last one? So good that teens will show off their braces in delight, fawn over the truckload of athletes and the gleam of another tuba. What if the exit we choose isn't the one we wanted? Each slate sings of late night fever, how headlights make us ache for passengers in other cars, their paper bags of takeout scenting the upholstery. Up ahead, a tractor trailer hits the shoulder, rights itself like a whale smacking back into the gulf, its huge body finding other huge bodies, somehow in the dark.
And now, where were you when you first got the idea for that poem?
After I lived in New York City for 13 years, and then I bounced around quite a bit. So I was in 6 locations in 8 years. And it's a bit disorienting, and I started to write poems that were very much kind of tied to place because I was trying to ground myself. And this poem is very particular. It's a stretch of highway between Atlanta, Georgia, and Gainesville, Florida, which is inundated with billboards, so much so that it is, I would imagine it's distracting. I'm not a very good driver anyway, but for me, it seems like a glut of these billboards, and they have just a wide range. So there are familiar ones for Applebee's and gas stations, and then there were a lot of strip club ads, these ads for strip clubs, at the same time that there would be these, what I thought of as very kind of brazen ads that were almost speaking from God. So it says, God says, and you would have kind of these dueling billboards. And I just thought about this crush, the spectacle, which in some ways I believe is uniquely American. It might be wrong, but this sort of stretch of highway to me feels very much like a spectacle and all of these different parts coming together.
With evangelism and sex.
Exactly. Evangelism and sex on the opposite sides of the street, on opposite sides of the highway.
And so how did that come into a poem?
So I started with an ad. I thought, I'm going to write about one of these beautiful women on these posters. And they, you know, have this sort of gorgeous, shiny hair. And how did that transpire? And it became a poem, like a lot of my poems, I think, about the disconnect between being lonely and alone while surrounded by other people. So you're on the highway, you're in the car by yourself, and yet you see people, you know, even children will wave or truck drivers will honk, and it's a communal experience even though you're isolated.
Why is there that the headlights make you want to know what's in the other car?
I think that's maybe my own personal voyeurism. I do want to know what conversations are happening in those other cars.
And why did we make it into couplets?
The couplets, I like the idea of sort of finding each other. So the whales finding other whales and sort of coming together, cars finding other cars. So these sort of, I suppose parallels. Which matches the, now that I'm thinking of it, you know, looks a little like a highway.
Aha! Yes, do you like that poem?
I do like this poem.
Well, you know what? I'm happy to hear that because, you know, nobody can like it if we don't. There's something about that. And so please give us another poem that you like.
After the human pincushion, Mabel. She cuts the fingers of her mistress clean off and practices scales with them. All those sharps and flats heavy with rigor mortis. Her paws never carpal tunnel, and this is a neat trick. The preeminent four-handed pianist. Each morning she takes the digits from the formaldehyde, rubs them with baby oil. But this is not what she meant, this flame, this bloodless intent. So rarely means love letters with fresh ears that listen to petulance, or a forest where every bit of undergrowth bends to little girl feet, those pink little boats.
Why is that so sad?
Because she's so alone, I think. So this is very much a character, and she wants to be connected so badly that she has killed someone so she could take her hands. It's a dark poem, but also I think what makes it dark is not the violence, but her loneliness, that she wants a connection.
Just before we end with a final poem, you must tell us about your career as a novelist. And you were at the Library of Congress researching. So is it for your new novel?
I'm working on my new novel here at the Library of Congress, which is just the most beautiful building and so inspiring. It's amazing to look out and see everyone so industrious.
How do you write a novel?
That's a good question. Every time I sit down, I think I can't do it.
And how did you know you could do it? How did you say, I can do this?
I never did. I did not think I could do it until I finished the first one, and then it was something of a surprise to me.
And let's talk about the latest one that's coming out in the fall.
Yes.
And what is the title of it?
It's called The Blue Kingfisher.
Is it a crime novel?
It's a crime novel. It's a mystery novel set in New York City. And I started writing the novel several years ago, and I got at least 15,000 words into it and realized that I'd just gone in entirely the wrong direction. It just wasn't making sense, so it was over the top. And I had to start over. I just scrapped everything I had. And
do you know how it's going to come out when you start?
I do not. I know that there are writers who create very thorough outlines, and I wish I could be so professional. To me, that seems very professional.
But do you know a skeletal of where you're going, even though the discovery will happen as you write it?
I usually, when I get to about the halfway mark, I can sort of start to very vaguely in the distance see the ending. What that means is I have a very messy first draft, and then the real kind of hard work happens, I think, during the second version.
You are my hero. Really, the marathon runner. How long will it take to write a novel?
It takes me a while. It takes me at least a year to have a draft that looks like a book, and then I sort of keep working.
We will be looking.
Thank you.
Erica Wright, let's have a final poem.
Inventory at 33. We got invites to Tampa burning through our pockets, and when we arrive, we'll swap swamp lies for gasoline to keep this car running. We got jumper cables snaking around a spare in the trunk and no use for expired license plates. We bet on red every time, like holy rollers gripping hymnals until their palms bleed onto their witness. We're saying we got a roadmap, but no roads that want us. Down along the highway, we close our eyes and will traffic into tides, every hint of tar into a starfish rotting on something called Beach Blanket Row. Then there's that miner's cough from whatever acids we gulped in the footprints of the country's tallest buildings. We got a racking that comes and goes. In the kitchen, there's a school of dead fish in the pipes. These are ours too, a handful of coins for the meter, an excuse about holes in our uniforms, and only one of us ever learned how to sew, and even then, only buttons. Still, we rip the blue with our canines and try again. When we were small, it snowed onto our backs while we slept, and we kept this ache inside of us for show and tell. The other kids yawned their reviews, pulled gangrene and jaundice from their backpacks, and we knew we'd always meet our matches. But then again, we'd always find another loose nail to throw with the others so that, given a gift of lumber, we could build ourselves a home right here in this pavement weed tangle no one's bothered with for years.
The fresh and vital voice of Erica Wright. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and Logan David Foundation, with additional support from the Sinopid Fund. The Poet and the Poem, already making broadcast history, can now be downloaded free on iTunes. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.